Good morning. You might not be able to change who'll run the country over the next 4 years, but you could shift your power to the positive. Democratic Party of Hawaii Chair Tim Vandeveer says that's the point of tomorrow's concert and rally. He'll join us this hour. And with revenue falling and big questions over balancing the budget, could the fight over money mean higher taxes and not just the permanent GET? We'll talk with Tax Foundation of Hawaii's Tom Yamachika. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. A 2002 graduate of the Mid-Pacific School of the Arts builds a career in action cinema. We'll meet actor Kaiivi Lyman Mercero. And we'll look ahead to the 2017 Kauai Quilt Show and look back on the centuries of tradition behind it.
It's Thursday, January 19th. Those conversations and a few more coming up on The Conversation after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
For at least some Americans, how shall I put it, positive thinking may be hard to come by over the inaugural weekend.
A little challenging, perhaps. But how that can be moved or maybe massaged a little bit seems to be what a lot of people are also starting to think about, because we know that there are people who are anxious over what will happen in the U.S. under soon-to-be President Donald Trump. And the point's already been made that for Hawaii, what happens in Washington may be a crucible of sorts for Hawaii. The challenge is how to shift power to the positive, and that's the purpose behind tomorrow's rally and concert of the same name at the Waikiki Shell. Tim Vandeveer chairs the Democratic Party of Hawaii and is on the line with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for making the time. I know you've been really challenged these days. So as you were looking at this idea of power to the positive, how would you define that?
Well, it's a way, I think, to translate some of the concern and anxiety, as you put it, into productive channels, into lifting up some of the organizations that have been doing good work in our community, nonprofit organizations, in many different ways, and getting involved and staying involved. And in doing that, really turning something that might be a negative into a positive.
It's sort of the subtitle of this is A Night of Unity. Unity in what sense? I mean, obviously coming together for a rally, a concert, seeing a lot of different organizations, and the list is long of how many are involved with it, and they are varied. But what happens to that unity as we move forward? How would you see that happening?
Well, I mean, that's really the reason why we decided to put this concert on and to invite all of these different organizations, which might seemingly be disparate, at least in the specific work that they do in these communities. But we wanted there to be a place and a way for people to come together. You know, Dr. King has been on our minds a lot this week, and really, I think, over this past election season for different reasons. But a quote that I heard this week, I'll kind of paraphrase, goes something like this: though we may have come here on different ships, we're in the same boat now. And I think the boat in that metaphor, I think Dr. King was speaking to income inequality and to many different things. But we felt it was necessary at a time where a lot of people are exercising their First Amendment rights, as they should, and getting out and making their voice heard, to have a way, as I said, to translate that energy into something productive, to stay involved. And that's really, I think, the thinking behind the concert. Is how do we keep this energy going? How do we keep people activated and organized and in the process?
That really is going to be the challenge, because it's great to bring people together for an evening or for a day and a march and a rally or a lot of the activities that will be happening from tomorrow onward. But keeping people engaged has always been an issue in Hawaii. When people had very, you know, personal things at stake or pet issues, this seems to be a different game, though. How do you intend to bring some of those disparate groups and the areas of confluence to the fore to keep people engaged as we move throughout the next 6 months, year, and beyond?
Well, this event is one way to do it, right, where you're bringing people together no matter what the issues are. One of the things that we decided very early on in having this event was to work out a mission of a statement of unity, what our mission is and what values we share, right? So whether you're working on environmental causes or civil liberties or, economic issues, a statement of values, things that we stand for, things that we will not compromise. The vast majority of the groups that are involved are apolitical, but we felt it incumbent upon us as the dominant political party to sort of set the table and bring these groups in. These are groups that share our values, that are already doing the hard work, that are already on the front lines. They represent communities, in many cases, that might be adversely impacted by the incoming administration. And so we wanted to make sure that people had a chance to see the good work that they're doing and say, okay, I can sign up for this. And by doing so, I know that this group is going to have this other group's back, right? So environment and organized labor have a lot of things in common. I would say much more in common than they have differences, but we need to make sure that we have each other's backs and that we're keeping all of our networks engaged and connected.
It's easy for us to use the word values. What specifically do you think are those values of Confluence with all of these groups that may have some very different ways of looking at what happens in Hawaii?
I think broadly speaking, it's the justices, environmental justice, racial justice, economic justice, social justice, those kinds of things. You don't really have to look much further than the platform of the Democratic Party, I think. But broadly speaking, those are the kind of things we're talking about.
I mean, you have everybody involved with this group from, you know, the Sierra Club and certainly the Democratic Party, but to people like the Pacific Roller Derby. This is a big list.
It is. It certainly is. And I think it shows not only, as you said, some of the anxiety in the different groups of folks, but also the good work that's already being done. In many cases that a lot of folks just don't know about or haven't engaged with.
So is there a plan that the Democratic Party has to be able to keep people engaged and to follow up on a lot of what certainly is going to be a lot of an enthusiasm tomorrow night and just a feeling maybe of just there's something that people can do, there's an avenue for them to take for some of their angst?
Yes, and this is part of it, right? So the first part is engaging our membership at the grassroots level and making sure that our precincts have capacity, our districts at the ground level, that those folks are staying involved and aware of what's going on. And then the other part is this event, where we're keeping our activist community involved and connecting people.
But
right?
even beyond the event, I guess, Tim, I'm saying that even beyond this event, because it's always what comes later, and we touched on that a little earlier, but do you actually have a plan to be able to keep these groups involved and to be able to have other places where they can come together to work on larger issues that will face Hawaii that may not see a lot of nods coming from Washington?
Most definitely. And this is not the last event we're going to have. And, you know, to the larger sense, you know, there's this notion of, I believe it comes out of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is stay woke, right? This notion that once you're awakened, once you become socially aware, that you have to stay engaged and you have to stay involved. And so, for instance, if you're working on an issue that involves the environment or Pacific Roller Derby, right, you're a young woman and you're empowered and you're involved, you're also, through that network, going to be connected with other people that are working on similar issues. And so you're staying engaged with what they're working on, and you're staying engaged with your community at large, and you know what other issues there are out there. And so you're not having to reinvent the wheel every time you go to organize folks. It's not just a rally next time, right? Then we're actually working on tangible things. And I should say, this isn't the only event we have throughout the day. Of course, this sort of is where the J20, what they're calling the J20 events, culminates that evening. But throughout the day, the University of Hawaii is holding a teach-in through this group, J20. They're having a rally in Waikiki. And then the party itself, the Democratic Party, is having a community service project in the morning, a chance for folks to give back and sort of reflect, not, you know, get caught up in all the noise that's coming out of Washington, D.C. But I believe, 8:30 to 10:30 at the Manoa Community Garden.
Tim, I'm going to stop you there because we'll publish a list of all of that stuff. I don't really want to take our airtime to list all that stuff. We'll certainly be able to have that available for people. But in general, what I'm hearing you say is that this is going to be a real different look at how the Democratic Party moves in Hawaii and brings people into the party itself and in communion with other groups that may or may not think that they have a whole lot in common until they begin to look at some of those real issues that may affect them. I want to thank you very much for giving us time this morning.
You bet, Bethann. Thank you. It's all about action. We got to cast a wider net, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Tim Vandeveer is the chair of the Democratic Party of Hawaii. Power to the Positive, the Night of Unity, will take place tomorrow night at the Waikiki Shell at 6 o'clock.
Tomorrow, Donald Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States. He'll take the oath, and NPR News will be there, carrying his inaugural address live to the nation and also following the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm Steve Inskeep. Join Audie Cornish and me for all the festivities. Special coverage of Inauguration Day from NPR News.
Tomorrow, beginning at 5 a.m., right here on HPR 2.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, an actor gets inside the mind of a death row inmate. First, though, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're visiting Ko'olawe, the eighth largest island in the Hawaiian archipelago. In ancient times, this neighbor of Maui and Lanai was called Kanaloa and was used by Polynesians to train in the art of celestial navigation. During Kamehameha III's reign, Ko'olawe was turned into a penal colony. Adult men who broke kapu were no longer put to death, but sentenced to life in exile. Food and water resources were scarce, so prisoners either starved or escaped by swimming to Maui. And in 1853, the penal colony law was repealed. Annual precipitation averages 25 inches, and dry conditions can be attributed perhaps to the fact that Ko'olawe is in the rain shadow of 10,000-foot-high Haleakala. For today's quiz, what's the highest point on this flat island? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Lynn Finnegan from the Hawaii Public Charter Schools Network. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
You never know just where your training as an actor is going to take you. Sometimes it can get things moving pretty fast. That's the way it is these days for Kaivi Lyman Mercero, a 2002 graduate of the Mid-Pacific School of the Arts. He has the lead role with Bruce Dern and Denise Richards in American Violence, a thriller that opens next month. He's now in Atlanta doing tactical weapons training for another movie. He got a lot of his early training, and he's on the line with us from Atlanta. Good morning, Kaivi.
Aloha, Chris. How are you?
All right. Did you, how much did you sort of anticipate about what the direction your career was going to take? Did you see much of this coming?
No, there's really there's not a lot of anticipation you can do, I think, as an actor starting off, unless you're one of those lucky few that, you know, land those huge trilogies or just a big movie right out the door.
Sure.
You know? If you're normal everyday actor, then it's just you go to the school of hard knocks and your best friend becomes rejection, and you just got to either deal with it or not.
What were your early gigs like?
Low budget horror movies.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and then here and there, some really well written stuff that you're like, wow, how come you know this big budget movie got made with an awful script and this really lower budget film has such an amazing script and great people working on it, and you know this doesn't have the money that it deserves.
There doesn't always seem to be a clear relationship between script and budget, does there?
No, it's never. You know, it's. There's no real formula in this business.
So, do you read a lot of scripts?
I do. Yeah. That's. I think that's 90% of my reading. Yeah.
And how are they circulated through agents, things like that? Some your agent might send you something that's this might be
my
good
manager,
for you.
Yeah.
So has that gotten you the movies you've been getting lately? Is that where that path
well, I
took
still,
you?
Yeah, some of them I'll get sent a script, but a lot of the times I'm still humbly auditioning, just with better projects that I actually want to be a part of. And I think that can make a difference in stuff. But, yeah, usually there's an audition, and then they like you, and there's a callback, and sometimes, a meeting with the director and the team, and then you just wait by the phone.
When you said rejection had become your best friend, have you worked out some – you've obviously worked out some ways to deal with that.
Yeah, it's – you got to weigh it out. Like, do I love what, I'm pursuing – more than anything in the world, and I'm ready to just do this for the rest of my life and deal with the rejection that comes with it. Or, I always say this, the entertainment business has a Darwin effect. Like, it weeds out the weak. The people that can't hang will drop out after, they had dreams of being rich and famous, 3-4 years into their career. And that's, that's unfortunately not how it works.
Yeah.
A lot of hard work. I think it was Jeffrey Rush who said he was a 30-year overnight sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure, and I think that happens for many people. But as you said, it really tests, whether you're all in or not. And there's no choice but except to be all in, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I remember telling my dad when I was younger, when I just moved to L.A., I think I had just booked my first film and I left college. I think I'd done barely a year and booked my first thing, and then I was not going back to college. And I think the question, well, what's plan B? And I've never even thought of that. There's been no plan B to me. It's, this is what I will do until they either drag me off or I'm dead,
In a way, if there were a plan B, that would be sort of this exit door as you walked out of a rejection at an audition that would, it would sort of comfort you in ways that maybe it shouldn't if you want to stay hungry, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just that helps fuel the fire to get work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Looking at the preview of your upcoming movie, there's a lot of you're a scary guy, right? And there's a lot of really intense, you have to kind of radiate danger even when you're sitting still in that role, it seems.
Yes.
So how do you get to that place?
This is one of those films where I read the script before I agreed to do it, and it blew my mind. A lot of times I'll page through maybe 5 or 10 pages and then put the script down and, go about my day and then come back to it. But this, I couldn't, me and my wife both read it together, and it was a page turner. We couldn't stop. We finished the whole thing, and immediately got on the phone with the director and was like, I would love to do this. Yes. But unfortunately I didn't have the prep time that I wanted. Like, I got the script on a Tuesday afternoon and we started filming Wednesday morning, But I was very lucky that the director, Timothy Woodward Jr., he had a very clear vision on the character. And, you know, after those first couple weeks of kind of going through the easier stuff, we really found our rhythm. And then once we moved into kind of the dark side of the character, it was much easier. And we had developed, you know, Jackson Shea.
Your training came in your high school years, yeah?
Yes.
And what did that do for you when you terms of preparation?
The great thing about Mid-Pacific School of the Arts is that they're preparing actors at a college level. So the training that they give you those 4 years in high school is equivalent to what you would go to a college and get. And so much so that I remember when I did do that 1 year of college at Santa Monica Community College, I went into my first day of acting 101 in college, and I did a monologue, I think, from The Crucible, and they immediately moved me up to, you know, acting 103. And that has, you know, I'm not tooting my horn, that has everything to do with my training at MPSA. You know, that gave me the tools that just put me, you know, one step ahead of the curve. And I still, today, use the stuff that I learned, you know, when preparing our character, when breaking down a scene and whatnot.
Part of that would be based on a kind of a belief in the capacity of kids that age to absorb all that training. Seems to work for you, right?
Yeah, it worked for me. I mean, it's something that, you know, I wouldn't say I was the best student, but with acting, I excelled. You know, I think acting was the only thing I excelled at, but yeah.
Well, keep in touch as your career grows, Kaivi. Thanks very much for talking
with
us.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck on the next movie.
Thanks.
Mid-Pacific Institute 2002 graduate Kaivi Lyman-Mercero plays death row inmate Jackson Shea in American Violence, a new movie set for release in next month.
Good or bad, what Obama moment stands out to you?
President Obama's repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
For extending marriage rights to my community.
Obamacare has had the biggest impact on my life.
President Obama gave me hope for a better nation.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll hear your responses next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Heads of the legislature revealed their wish list at yesterday's opening of this year's session, and there seems to be little agreement except on the wish for a solution this time around for a project that continues to plague Oahu. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check of Kochi, Suki, and Rail. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth. Yeah, good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, we heard them yesterday, and clearly we want a solution, but for example, with, you know, Senate President Kochi, he didn't really say how that might come about or suggest how that might come about. We did hear something different from Joe Suki in the House. Is there any conversation that's happening between the two chambers on this?
Well, of course, it's early. It's only the second day of session. I think what Ron Kochi was saying yesterday was that, well, he did say, look, we're going to have a conclusion of some sort on rail. Are we going to extend the GET surcharge on Oahu? We'll wait and see. But he did make clear that there will be some sort of resolution. It will be perhaps the most pressing issue at the legislature. But he didn't have a lot of details. He suggested that a lot of it is going to depend on the city and on HART providing a heck of a lot more information about how they're going to pay for rail. He said the Senate is wide open ideas. He also suggested there may be some difficulty working with the House on some of the aspects of dealing with the GET. And a somewhat pessimistic position, the opposite really of Joe Suki, who actually has a solid plan in place for what to do with the GET.
I mean, and he gave, you know, some of the details of all of that, and he actually pointed back, you know, to the city and looked to what might be coming from the city should, in fact, they allow the city to participate by changing how the GET is collected.
Right. And just briefly on what the speaker is saying, let's get rid of the sunset date on the surcharge extension. It's supposed to end in 2027. Make it permanent in perpetuity. Cut the tax from 0.5 to 0.425. Cut that skim that they levy, the administrative fee, from 10 to 5%. But one thing he did say, and it ties into what you just brought up, somehow the city has to demonstrate skin in the game. There's actually a city ordinance in place that says rail funding only comes from federal funding and from the GET. It doesn't come from any other source. And the suggestion from Suki, and particularly Jill Takuda in the Senate WAM, Ways and Means, said they got to show some skin in the game. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean property taxes? I don't know, but that seems to be it's something that they're going to really have to work hard on to get a resolution in order to keep funding rail.
It seems, though, that House Finance Chairwoman Sylvia Luke and Senator Jill Takuda with WAM, they seem to be presenting a pretty united front on certain issues, this one included. Does that?
Yeah, their bottom line.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
we're so excited because it's a new session. Well, just briefly, I can tell you that Sylvia Luke and Jill Takuda, what they want are hard numbers from the city and heart. They don't want to be given a set of numbers that turn out to not be true. Meanwhile, they're levying this tax, you know, on Oahu taxpayers. That, I think, is the most important thing. They need to see solid data on how much this thing is going to cost going forward.
Yeah, I think we all want to see solid data.
Yes, we do.
Thanks very much, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Every day, Chad Blair joins us from Civil Beat with a reality check.
And thanks for listening to the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. And a program note, on February 14th, our 6th anniversary, the conversation will be moving from Valentine's Day forward. We'll be airing from 11 a.m. to noon on HPR 1. The time may be changing, but you can expect the same thoughtful discussion of issues and the arts. And as always, you can join the conversation by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, your taxes in 2017, and later, traditional Hawaiian quilting after the news from Deutsche Welle.
It's easy to say that every legislative session is about money, because in the end, well, it is. But how lawmakers decide how to spend it, well, that defines what we value. With state revenue now projected to be $155 million lower, the stakes are higher over how your tax-paying dollars are spent and what continued or new taxes might be in your future. We asked Tax Foundation of Hawaii President Tom Yamachika for his analysis, and he's with us now in our studio. Good morning.
Morning, Bethann.
Good to see you, and welcome to the 2017 session.
Yeah, same to you.
As we look at some of the conversation, and I know you heard some of the conversation earlier this morning with Chad that came out of yesterday's opening, obviously the GET surcharge and rail is one of the top line issues. What's your view of whether or not we're going to see this move in perpetuity and the fact that the Tax Foundation has been so adamantly against this?
We've seen this conversation before. As you may recall, Mayor Caldwell came in a couple of years ago saying, yeah, we should have this in perpetuity. And the legislature at that time just gave him 5 years after, you know, a very long and contentious session with lots and lots of debate and lots of different and shifting positions throughout the session. That's kind of what they wound up doing, just giving him, you know, 5 more years. So the money chairs especially are skeptical. They want to see, a shared effort. They want to see the city government and the city council having more having more skin in the game, as I think one lawmaker put it.
They also want to see real hard numbers, real data, as we just talked about with Chad.
That's absolutely right. The money chairs have been complaining about that before, and you know, frankly, some of the numbers in the previous presentations didn't add up. So they had every right to be skeptical, and with so much money at stake, it's probably their duty to be skeptical at this point.
This also harkens back to conversations from many years ago when there was the bottom line question, well, you know, you might build it, but how are you going to maintain it? That was never really answered.
Yeah, now people are looking at $200 million a year, $100 million just for the maintenance, and another $100 million per year in what we call a sinking fund, because you know, cars and tracks don't last forever. You have to replace things. So that's what the sinking fund would be used for.
At this point, where we're seemingly second verse, same as the first, but louder this time because there's less money, and also a lot of people who have just said, yeah, we want rail finished, and we want it to go all the way to Ala Moana. Is this just going to be something that we're going to have to suck up, that there will be this forever after GET?
Well, it certainly looks that that way because, you know, if it goes to Ala Moana in year one, somebody's going to want it to go to UH next, or to Waikiki next, or to, you know, or further west. So it's going to be something that keeps on going. I mean, other transportation systems, you know, rail systems in the U.S. mainland and elsewhere have, you know, had that kind of you know, growing proclivity. So you know, why you know, why wouldn't it apply to us as well?
Transportation has been an overarching issue for the Tax Foundation. You just recently wrote a commentary for this week about a fee that we don't really talk about a whole lot, but yet we all manage to pay because we consume goods and most of them are brought in from elsewhere. That's part of your transportation trifecta. Explain that a little bit more fully.
Okay, well, what I was writing about in the article was the harbor fees. The Harbors Division of the Department of Transportation, which is one of their three divisions, has legislative authority to issue regulations to impose fees. And what they've done with it, with that legislative authority, is they're going to be phasing in increases in the harbor fees to, you know, upgrade the harbors, Kapalama Terminal included. And they're like double digit increases for over like 3 years, so it's a very large number, and that doesn't go to the legislature at all. It's given to them by legislative authority, so the legislature can do something about it if they wanted to, but right now the Harbors Division has regulatory authority to kind of jack the fees up, you know, pretty much to do what they want. Now, when I talked about the transportation trifecta, I was thinking about the fees and taxes feeding the highway fund, which include the gas tax, the vehicle weight tax, and the vehicle registration fee. Now that was being pushed very heavily last session. It got killed in the House Transportation Committee, but it's going to be coming back. Yeah, we don't know officially until the bill is introduced, but we have every indication that it's going to be coming back.
With all of what you've just said, the fact that, you know, we saw that happen, that was more of a transparent discussion. But what happened with harbors wasn't so transparent with that. But you're making the point that there are a lot of fees that come out of our pockets that we don't necessarily focus on when we look at the price of something. We're just aware that the price has increased.
That's right. It gets baked into everything.
So at this point, with that also being part of the mix, I want to ask you a little bit more about what's happening with the counties and the TAT, because last year there was a big push, as there always is, to be able to get more of a share of that. This year I would expect we'd see more of that too.
Yeah. As you may recall, last year we had a task force study that came out recommending a certain methodology of dividing the TAT between the state and the counties. In 2013, when the TAT rate was increased, the county was given a fixed number. I think it was $93 million. And then the legislature increased it to $103 million per year for a couple of years while this task force was sorting it out. So we had some part of the conversation last session, but the last year's legislature just basically kicked the can down the road one more year. So we're going to be
picking up that can
this time
around. But the idea of putting more or making visitors shoulder a little bit more of the burden for this, and even for the there's a part of that conversation of the GT surcharge too. Is that going to undercut visitor engagement at all, do you think?
Well, you never know. I mean, you start squeezing things, and there will be effects. You don't really know what they are, but we don't think they're going to be good.
All right. At that ominous point, we're going to say goodbye for today, but we'll be checking in with you as we move through session.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Thank you for being here. Tax Foundation President Tom Yamachika is will be joining us during the session as we move through. You're listening to The Conversation.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small?
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Circus Incognitus with clown Jamie Adkins in a show for all ages, this Saturday evening at 7:30 in Castle Theater. MauiArts.org.
Tonight, 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and one of the things at this stage as the legislature opens is the sheer volume of bills under consideration.
And, right? You know, it's always that way, right? There are, are several thousand bills that get, pumped over to the legislature, and it's the idea of, in the first half of what's going to stick, and then we kind of get down to business within the second half.
Exactly.
But we are looking at what's emerging this time around. You don't have huge, huge issues except for the big one about rail and the GT surcharge, perhaps.
Yeah.
But all these other issues that are very important to people, very important to the lawmakers and their constituencies. And what does that list look like? And for all of you listening, what are you paying attention to this time? What's on your list? You know, you hear people saying, take all that energy you've got and do something
right.
with it. So what are you going to do this session and with those bills that you find most meaningful?
Yeah. Do you feel that your wishes are being considered, given the proper weight, all of that?
So Colin Moore and Neil Milner are coming back, as they always do this time of year. And we're going to sit down and compare lists. And those lists are kind of long. We want to hear from you, too.
Try to make sense of it all. Thanks, Beth Ann.
The answer to today's backyard quiz, which took us over to Kahoolawe. It's the smallest of the 8 major Hawaiian islands, measuring 11 miles long by 6 miles wide, and has a land area of 4.6 square miles. Ancient Hawaiians call the island Kanaloa. It's uninhabited today, but archaeological evidence shows there were small populations living in fishing villages along the coastline. Researchers believe settlements would be limited in size due to the lack of a source of fresh water. The island's low annual rainfall is attributed to the fact that Kahoolawe sits in the rain shadow of its 10,000-foot-tall neighbor, Haleakala. A rain shadow is a dry area on the leeward side of a mountainous area away from the wind. To make the point about the island's flat state, consider this. The highest point on Ka'olawe is a point called Pu'u Moalua Nui along the Lua Makika crater, which stands 1,477 feet above sea level. That's the answer to today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, because nobody got today's answer, Chris, so we'll just hang on to our prize.
Heavy and, sigh.
Heavy sigh, but maybe we all learned a little.
That's right.
Aloha. I'm Vice Admiral Phil Cullum from the United States Navy. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Traditional Hawaiian quilting was once a kind of secret family art form, with each ohana closely guarding its traditions. Today, it's an intersection of techniques brought here by missionary families with long-established Hawaiian tapa traditions. Kauai fabric artist Lee Ingram is an heir to all of them, and with her, we're going to look ahead to the 2017 Kauai Quilt Show. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Chris.
This is sort of art meets function, isn't it, the art of the quilt?
Yes, definitely, and it goes both ways. Sometimes they're just functional, and sometimes they're really just art pieces.
Yeah, which encompasses quite a wide range, doesn't it?
It really does. There's so many different ways of doing quilting these days, almost as many different ways as there are people doing it.
Well, how many people have you got, for instance, in your guild on Kauai?
Well, we have two groups that are involved with the show, and in the Kauai Quilt Guild, there's probably about 50 members, and then in the Nene's Quilters, there's probably about 30. So, and some of them overlap a little bit, but there are also people that enter the show that do not belong to either group.
So you've got, I mean, that for, given the population of Kauai, that's quite a few people, isn't it?
You know, it's really gained in popularity in the last 3 years. So, yeah, I think we have a really great amount of people considering the population, like you said.
So what do you attribute that growing popularity? It's been around for a long time.
You know, I think that lately there's been a surge of new, younger people coming into it. For a long time, it was just, you know, the people who are retired who get back into quilting because they used to sew when they were younger. But nowadays, it's just taken on a big popularity with a lot of the younger crew, and we have a whole new kind of quilting. It's called modern quilting, which is kind of minimalist and more impressionistic, not so much the old traditional patterns, and that sparked a lot of interest from the younger people. So I think there's a lot of factors in that.
Yeah, it's interesting that it should even have a modern dimension, because you do think of it as a celebration of history and tradition.
Correct, yeah. And there are still a lot of people that are really into the traditional kind of quilting. But, you know, it's always exciting to take anything in a new direction. And that excitement is what sparking interest in it. And I think it's really wonderful. There's places and times and places for both of those applications. And at first I was kind of like, oh, modern quilt, yuck, you know. But I have to say I've been totally hooked, and I'm getting into doing some of them myself, although I still love all the old traditional ones as well.
And the way you're defining modern is really that it would have more of an abstract feel, an abstract pattern or lack of pattern?
Correct. Like the traditional old quilts were made from scraps of fabric that were left over from other projects or used from clothing that was worn out. So they would cut away the worn parts and yeah. use the good parts. Modern quilts a lot of times are very simplistic with lots of big areas of plain fabric. You never used to see that in an old traditional quilt because they just didn't have large pieces of fabric to work with often.
Which is another sort of function dictates form kind of
exactly.
direction.
Yeah.
You know, the way it's been described to me, the missionaries brought over a obviously European-based style of quilting. And there was a kind of some similarity, some overlap to what Hawaiians have been doing with tapa cloth. Is that accurate?
Well, kind of. Like the designs that came from the Hawaiian quilting were definitely inspired by the tapa cloth. The Hawaiians got into doing two pieces of fabric, one overlayered the other, and sort of like one big piece, because they actually thought that it was kind of cheap or small to do something out of little scraps. So they liked to express themselves with larger pieces of fabric, which to them seemed a little more, affluent, you could say, or just less picky. So that whole thing happened, you know, it just evolved in a natural way with their designs on tapa cloth, and they loved how you folded the paper piece, like kind of like cutting out a snowflake out of paper and doing that. It's very intricate, and it's just exquisite work. Not a whole lot of people do that these days.
That's how you do a quilt design? You cut out a piece of paper and make the cloth conform to it?
You cut out a big, that's for a Hawaiian quilt. You mm-hmm. cut out your design out of a big sheet of paper. You fold it kind of like you did when we were kids in school making snowflakes. And then you trace that onto a piece of fabric.
Oh, I see.
Open it up when you've got it all cut out. You trace it onto a piece of fabric, and then you cut that design out. And then you lay that on top of another piece of fabric. And you turn the edges, you pin it all down, and you turn the edges under as you stitch it on, which is, you know, called needle turn applique.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all hand-stitched on. And then comes the quilting part. When you layer the quilt together, the definition of a quilt is actually three layers of fabric. There's traditionally the top piece, which we see and look at, and then there's the middle piece, which is the batting, and they used to use wool, of course, and then the bottom layer, which is called the backing. So when those three pieces are put together and stitched together, then that's called a quilt.
And it actually keeps you warm at night, which is the beauty part. Thanks a lot.
I know,
that's great. Thank you so much. And the 2017 Kauai Quilt Show is February 10th at the Kauai Society of Artists Gallery in Lihue's Kukui Grove Shopping Center. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On January 21st, in the Atherton studio, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Barry Barrick narrates Twinge, the contemporary music piece adapted from his cover story. The Haven Trio performs this 15-song cycle by Hawaii composer John Magnuson, dedicated to the victims of the Indonesian tsunami. More at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
So, Beth Ann, it would seem that some hike in taxes was pretty much inevitable.
Well, you know, remember the days when people said, you know, the tax for the convention center, the tax for the,
yeah.
the you know, for rail, for the GT surcharge, it's only temporary. Well, as we know, temporary has a very different meaning in Hawaii. And what happens as we go forward? Well, we're going to find out as we're now into session and seeing how we're going to be fighting over money.
A certain amount of bracing yourself would seem to be called for.
It happens every year. Now, that's going to do it for our show for today and for the week, because tomorrow the conversation will be preempted. NPR will cover the Trump inauguration, and we'll all be listening along with you with coverage starting at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning.
You can tell it, Mel.
How about I say that part? You can tell us how you feel about taxation or any of the other stories that we've covered. You can leave us a message on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation and on Twitter at HI Conversation. And you can get to me at BKOZHPR. You can also check out the show and hear it again or anything else on the archive on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning.